for those of you who are not so familiar with the subject. After that, I'll go on and discuss our numerical construction of non-uniform black strings in this theory. So these objects are a special class of black hole solutions in this theory. So I'll explain how we construct them in high dimensions. And as we will see, we uncovered some interesting and unexpected properties of these objects. And after that, I'll go on and discuss Reynolds inequalities. I'll explain what these are and how they can be used to study the stability of black holes. And then I'll apply these Reynolds inequalities to study stability of black strings. And I'll end with summary and interactions. So if anyone you have questions, just stop me and I'll try to answer. Very good. So let me start with a review of studying black holes in quantum theory. So in this talk, I'll be considering vacuum general relativity in d dimensions, and I'll take one of these dimensions to be compact. That's what I'll refer to as the Coulomb-Quantum circle. So moreover, within the second, I'll consider static black holes, which moreover have this SOD-2 symmetry in the non-compact directions. So asymptotically, the magic will look like this, where these are the non-compact direction, so these sphere will be preserved everywhere in spacetime, and moreover, we have this other direction here, which is the compact direction, which has length L. So the simplest objects within this theory are the so-called structure of black strings. You can construct them analytically by simply making the d-1 dimensional symmetrically flat photon solution. You add a flat direction, then this solves the Einstein vacuum equations in d dimensions, and then you take this direction to be compact. Okay. Now this solution has a horizon topology, S1 plus SD-3, but of course it's not flat. And moreover, we call it also a uniform black string because the horizon extends uniformly along the compact direction. Now, remarkably, this solution, simple as it is, turns out to be unstable under gravitational perturbations when the size of the black hole, you know, hopefully it's visible, r plus, over this size of the compact circle L. This is a number which is order 1. So when Nevelis is smaller than this number, but order 1, then there exists exponentially growing modes in this baseline. And moreover, these perturbations break the translational symmetry along this circle. So that's a very important result done by Grove theory and the Mormon plan, which is somewhere in the city now.
What happens to the black hole in this case?
Yeah, I'm going to discuss this.
Okay.
So, there you go. So whenever you have an instability, the natural question to ask is what happened? Okay? And well, so initially it was suggested that these black strings would be dropped in finite time. But of course, this can happen in classical general relativity because horizons cannot bifurcate. So if they have to be dropped precisely at the moment where they break, they should form a singularity, which would be visible. And recent calculations by Louis and Franz Pretorius provide very strong evidence that this is indeed what happened. And of course, this has very far-reaching consequences, which is basically that cosmic censorship in high dimension may just not hold. Very good. So let me go back to our main character of this talk, which are non-uniform black strings. So in particular, of all these modes that Gregory and Lafan found, there is one which is time-independent, but nevertheless breaks the translational symmetry on this circle. Okay? So if you take your structure of that string and you add to it this mode, then you construct a solution, the linearized Einstein equations corresponds to a black string, but with a tiny perturbation, which is non-uniform on this compact direction, and that's, of course, a non-uniform black string. Now it turns out that this linearized solution lifts to a full non-linear solution, and these are the non-uniform black strings, which were initially constructed in nonlinear perturbation theory and fully non-intuitive in numerical. Now, these solutions, before the work of Louis and others, people who were desperate for saving, say, cosmic censorship in high dimensions, suggested that maybe they could be the endpoint of the Gregorian Lafan stability and that everything would be fine. But it turned out that as soon as these numerical conclusions became available, it turned out that people realized that they have less entropy than uniform black strings in the same mass. So therefore, uniform black strings cannot evolve into this object. And in fact, but of course, constructing these non-uniform black strings in high dimensions turned out to be hard, as I'll describe later. And in higher dimensions, only perturbative calculations were available. And then, of course, you can do this perturbative construction in all dimensions. And it was realized that with the non-perturbative black string, in dimensions 30 or less, they always have less entropy than the uniform black string with the same mass. And but the situation changes in dimensions greater than 30. So why 13? I don't know. But that was just an observation. Okay, so now talk about black strings, non-uniform black strings. So let me show you how they look like. So this is an embedding of the horizon of a non-uniform black string in 11 dimensions into the Euclidean space. Okay? Now this is the compact direction, so you should identify these two ends. And clearly this horizon is not uniform of this compact direction. At 11 dimensions. And okay, so in this embedding, so these circles here are just the spheres of the horizon. Okay? So this is in 11 dimensions, it's interesting because as you go up in dimensions, these horizons of these black strings become rounder and rounder. As we'll see later, in the five dimensions, these non-uniform black strings, they are rather elongated along the compact direction. But as you go up in dimensions, they become more round. Because that's ultimately because gravity in five dimensions is more localized, so it's more faster. So all the effects just happen in a sort of tiny medium. And this is why it's harder to construct this object in five dimensions, because functions have steeper gradients and you need to resolve them. So that's why it's hard. Very good. So, it is useful to parameterize these black strings in terms of the so-called non-uniformity parameter, which basically measures the ratio between the maximum and the minimum radius of the sphere on the horizon. So that's the radius of these ST minus 3 spheres. So, for non-uniform black strings, it exists for all values of lambda greater than 0. And when lambda is infinite, then basically the minimum radius becomes 0, and at that point, these non-uniform black strings are thought to merge with another branch of solutions, namely localized black holes, which have localized black holes on this circle, and they have horizon topology ST minus. So, these localized black holes have been constructed perturbatively and also numerically only in 5 and 6 dimensions, and when they are very small, they really don't know that they live in a compact space, so they basically move around. But as they move along the branch of these solutions, they become bigger and bigger, and they start feeling that they live in a compact space, they're getting multiform, and they just fill all these, in the end, they end up filling all this compact circle, and precisely at this point, they merge with these non-uniform black strings. And the geometry, precisely at this merger point, has very special properties, but unfortunately, I won't have time to discuss them further. Something that was observed in this numerical construction of these localized black holes is that there exists a maximum mass along this black hole branch. So the mass of these localized black holes cannot be greater than some number. And this already hints to the possibility that these objects, at some point, they may become unstable. Because if you sit at this black hole with maximum mass, I can imagine that you can throw a particle into it and then ask nowhere else to go. So something has to happen. And I'll come back to this point later. Okay, so Toby Wiseman produced this beautiful image summarizing all the known static black holes phases in quantum quantum theory in five dimensions. So up here, we've got the weakly non-uniform black string. So again, you have to identify these ends. So you see that these strings there are just small perturbation of a uniform black string. So as you move along the branch, you increase lambda, so they become more and more deformed. And clearly, you reach a point where these are highly deformed and they're close to merging. Merging with the other phase, which are the localized black holes. So again, when they are small, which is somewhere there, they look basically round. So in this image, these rods represent the length, the proper length of the compact circle on the horizon. Okay, so when they are small, they're basically round, but as they grow, they become more and more deformed. And at some point, clearly, one might guess that these two values will merge. And that is critical for the job. So in these black holes, the one basically maximum mass. So okay, so that's just the summary of all known phases in five dimensions, and in high dimensions within these symmetries, that's basically what we know. So okay, so this is all very nice. We have all these black holes. So now we want to ask which of these are stable and in which region of parameters, because it's very nice to have all these objects, but we want to know which of them physically relevant and in which region of the phase diagram. Okay? So clearly, as I said, small black holes, in these localized black holes, when they are small, they are basically round and they are approximately like asymptotically black, short term black hole in five dimensions, which is not stable. So small localized black holes should be stable. On the other hand, I told you that there exists a solution with maximum mass, which naively you would think that it is unstable. So clearly something will happen to these objects as you move along the branch of solutions. On the other hand, for the non-uniform black strings, we know at least in lower dimensions where they were constructed to sort of by a sort of non-perturbative regime, they have less entropy than the non-uniform black string with the same mass. So you might think that they might be unstable because you get principal perturbed and evolve into the uniform black string. This remains true at least perturbatively up to 13 dimensions, but in high dimensions, less than greater than 13 now, there were non-perturbative black strings, and the perturbative results suggest they have greater horizon area than the uniform black string in the same mass, so you might hope that they might be stable. And the rest of this talk, what I'm going to discuss, is the stability of this non-uniform black string with finite matter. So there'll be non-perturbative, non-uniform black string. And I'll leave the localized black holes. Very good. Okay, so I'll talk now, introduce these objects, and now I'm going to describe the numerical construction of this non-uniform black string. And we did this up from 10 to, say, 15 dimensions, because, as I said before, it becomes harder and harder to construct these solutions numerically in high dimensions because gradients are steeper, so you need to resolve this. And in fact, you need to formulate the problem properly so that you can find the solutions. And so, first of all, I'm going to describe the method that we use. And this is basically the work of these three gentlemen. So let me go through this. So we want to solve the Einstein-Watson equation to the dimensions, and there are basically two contexts in which we are interested in doing that. In the case where we want to find, say, static or stationary spacetimes, then we would like to pass the Einstein equations in elliptic form so that we can solve them as a standard boundary value problem. When we are interested to study, say, dynamical spacetimes as a linear area. Two, then we would like to pass the Einstein equations in a hyperbolic form so that we can solve them as an initial value problem. But as it is well known, then the Einstein equations don't have a definite character. They're not elliptic, they're not hyperbolic, and the ultimate reason is because the homomorphism is there. Right? So one has to implement some kind of gauge fixing, and then you are able to solve them one way or another. And what I'm going to tell you now is a way of implementing a particular gauge for the elliptic problem. Now, one of the most successful gauges that have been used in GR to say either prove formal results, like bosons and so on and so forth, is the harmonic gauge. And also in numerical GR, this has been very successfully used. So what I'm going to tell you now is how to implement this generalized harmonic gauge fixing in the context of the elliptic problem. Okay? So this method actually is not new, and in fact it was borrowed from the early literature in Ricci flow, where the term used it to prove that Ricci flow is in fact parabolic. So there is a problem. So as I told you, the Einstein equations, they don't have a definite character, so basically what one does is you just add another term to the equations so that you kill the terms which have bad second order derivatives. And the way to do it is just to add this vector with this covariant derivative, where this vector is constructed by taking a different two connections. So one is the connection associated to the metric that I'm trying to find, and the other is the connection associated to, say, a background metric that leads to the manifold, which I fix once and forever. So in the context of the dynamical evolutions, then people basically also implement this gauge fixing, but you usually, in most cases, at least the ones that I'm more familiar with, you only have this piece, and then you have just another vector, which in a way defines your gauge. But in the elliptic problem, it's convenient to put it like this, because now this object transforms as a vector. And in general, you will not be able to cover your manifold in a single coordinate patch. So it is convenient that this object transforms in a nice way, so that you can transfer information from one patch to another in an easy way. In the dynamical case, in most cases, people just use, say, one single Cartesian coordinate patch, then you don't have to worry about doing coordinate transformations. So that's why it's not an issue. Yeah. So what is that the thing to do? So this is a good thing to do, because now the principal symbol of this equation now is just this one, so that this equation is now either manifestly elliptic or hyperbolic. So then you can solve it using standard methods. And clearly, this condition is our cage fixing condition. So this vector in the sort of time evolution case is what you normally call the constraint vector. So setting this to zero basically is equivalent to saying that the space-time coordinates satisfy a generalized harmonic equation where the source is specified by this connection that you fix what you bring. So that's our cage fixing condition. Very good.
Are you going to say why? Why that looks like the tensor, and you.
Sorry,
are you going to say why that looks like? Why that transforms as a vector?
Well, because it's a general result in differential geometry, right? When you take the difference between two connections, that object transforms like a vector. And
I think this is a longer discussion, so we'll.
Okay, well, basically, a connection doesn't transform as a tensor, right? So you call extra pieces, and when you take the difference between two connections, then that object transforms like a tensor, but not the connections taken individually. When you do coordinate transformations, that's a
good enough. Keep going.
Okay.
But you know when is the work by the term?
Right.
When did the work by the term?
I think it was early 81 or something like that.
Like then, what you call it? It's okay, but she did it in the context.
Yeah, but she did it in the context of the initial value problem with GR.
But it's the same.
And the term, it's.
But it's the same. Right.
It's more or less the same, but he also did it in the context of, well, principle, the parabolic problem. Yeah, I agree, but I think it happens that several things are discovered independent of what I did. Okay, very good. So I'm saying that we are not solving the Einstein equation, we're just solving another set of equations, but they're only equivalent to the Einstein equations when this vector is equal to zero. So basically, the point is now how can we achieve this, okay? So clearly, this of course, the answer to this question depends on the problem you are considering, and in the hyperbolic case, basically what you do, you just impose you choose the initial data so that this vector and its first time derivative vanish from the initial data slice, and then under evolution, this condition is preserved, okay? So you're actually solving the Einstein equation all the time. Now, in the elliptic context, this is kind of more subtle, and basically the bottom line is that you have to solve these equations subject to boundary conditions so that which are compatible with this vector vanishing at the boundary. But in general, you cannot impose that this vector is zero at the boundaries because it just turns out to be not compatible with the vorticity of the curve, so you have to be careful. So that's why you have to choose boundary conditions which are compatible, because you don't always can enforce this. That's a rather subtle point. But in any case, with this boundary condition, then you go on and solve the Einstein equations. Well, you actually solve this equation, so basically what you are doing, you're solving the Einstein equation and the gauge condition at the same time. So you don't achieve this gauge until you solve your equations. So that's an important difference between this elliptic and hyperbolic problem. Okay? And so whilst it's true that a solution, an Einstein metric, in this particular gauge, solves these Einstein third equations, then the converse is not true. And in fact, there are solutions to this equation where this vector is not vanishing, and they are known as rich solvents in the math literature, and they are interesting for a number of reasons, but basically in this talk, I want to avoid them. Okay? Now, it turns out that given a manifold, then boundary conditions, in some cases, you can actually prove that no Ricci solenoids exist. And that's an odd result by these authors in the case of compact manifolds without boundaries. And we prove a similar result in the case of non-compact manifolds with various asymptotics, namely for the flat, multiplying, run by the sitter. And, well, actually, our proof is very different from that, and it uses maximum principles, you need certain terms to be positive, and that's why you need a cosmological constant to be non-positive for our proof to work. But I mean, more fundamentally, because it's equation is analytic, so basically, once you fix boundary conditions, the solution should be locally unique.
Right.
So either if you solve this equation, I mean, your metric is either Einstein or Ricci solenoid, right? You cannot be both. So even if you cannot prove a result like that, then if you find a metric, you can always check whether it's Einstein or not, right? But if you have this, if you have a result like that, then well, of course you solve it numerically, so these vectors will not be zero. But you can check whether this vanishes in the continuing limit.
Yes.
What kind of method do you use to solve the Einstein equations then? But one often uses a conformal decomposition. You're doing something different, right? Because you mentioned harmonics.
Yes, it does. You just solve them directly.
So you do the harmonic decomposition essentially,
Sorry, what do you mean by the harmonic decomposition? Maybe I don't understand.
You don't want to solve the full Einstein equation.
Yes.
You only want to, I mean, you leave out the time evolution equations. And the remainder, they say it's already good enough, it has the right elliptic form, that
so
you can just stuff it into a numeric algorithm and then.
So basically, because some I'll be interested in say, static or stationary space time. So there is no time, right? So all the equations are elliptic. So
because you set the time derivatives to zero.
Well, exactly, because my metric has no time dependence.
Okay, so is this the generic way of solving the constraints?
So the point is that in this formulation, there are no constraints. You don't have constraints. So all the equations become dynamical. You know, in other words, all the equations, for all the Einstein equations, all the components, the principal symbol is this sort of elliptic operator that you have. So there are no constraints to worry about. So the constraints, if you want, are the boundary conditions. So you have to ensure that this vector vanishes.
I don't fully understand that. I think I'll read a paper later.
I think in the generic translation, what you call dynamic, you would call, it depends on all the coordinates, but there is no time. What you're calling, there are no constraints, we would call them precisely the constraints of your system. As you said, we're solving completely constrained system, there's no dynamics. We cannot find the configurations.
Okay.
It's a little bit of translation.
Okay.
So what is the state vector, the variables for which you solve? Is it just the four metric or also it's
the four metric? Well, actually, this is high dimensional. You'll see it in the example in a second. you can
just four metric, yes.
Yeah. You solve for the four metric, including the TT and the mix.
And you set the time derivatives to zero.
Exactly.
Okay,
so my metric functions, they are all independent of time. Okay? Okay, good. So I think that's an important point, because now we can use this quantity to monitor how good our numerical solution is. Okay? Good. Okay, so your question came to the right point. So now that I've explained this method, now let me show you how you actually implement it to find these non-uniform knots. So basically, the rules of the game are the following. So you write down a metric which has the isometries that you want. Mainly, in our case, you want to be independent of time, so time translations and SOD minus 2 symmetry. So you write down the most general metric which has these symmetries and which is closed under diffeomorphisms that preserve this symmetry. In the case of the non-uniform black strings, then this is the general form of the metric. So all functions here are functions of this y and x coordinates. So here my unknowns on these functions t, s, a, b, and f, and they depend, as I said, on both x and y. So x is my compact direction, and y is a sort of a radial coordinate, which is very basically compact, and it's defined in terms of the usual short-shot radial coordinate way. And the other function there, okay. So here, again, in this case, we have to choose a background metric to fix the gauge. So in our case, we choose just the uniform black string, which is perceived by this metric setting all these functions, TS, A, and B, so on, so forth, zero. So that's our gauge choice. And with this gauge choice, then we can just plot this metric into the Einstein equations, and we find that all these functions, TS, A, B, and so on, they all satisfy an elliptic equation. Okay? And the boundary conditions that we'll impose is that we want our metric to be asymptotic to the prime. This just amounts to say setting all these functions to zero at infinity, which in these coordinates, so y equals 1. Then also we'll impose regularity at the horizon, which in this case is that y equals 0. And we'll just require that to come up that period in this sort of period. Then Now, I want to emphasize that with this boundary condition, our theorem holds, and it tells us that no Ricci soliton can exist. So if we find a solution, then it must be the Einstein metric that we are interested in. Okay? So to solve we solve this harmonic Einstein equation, so the Einstein Dirac equations, and we use the spectral multi-domain method, so we have high resolution in the regions where it's needed, because this will change as you move along the branch, you can imagine that you know, they want to pinch, so have a region where you've got large gradients, we need to resolve that, and we also you know keep the computational process under control, so we can do this multi-domain
side. So how difficult it is actually to check that sine mu equals to zero? It shouldn't be difficult, right? So why
once you found the solution, then you just evaluate it. And
right, so why do you care about solitons? You shouldn't, you wouldn't.
Well, the thing is that if I know that in the continuum limit, I know that sine has to vanish.
Right.
So I can use sine as a measure. But of course, if you solve this numerically, then sine is not zero. By numeric, it's never zero. Right? But I know that in the continuum limit, it must be zero. So if a solution exists and it's smooth, then this quantity has to vanish as I you know, approach the continuum limit, so I can check whether that's true. And this tells me you know, how I converge to the continuum limit. In particular, in this case, because we use spectral methods, this quantity will converge exponentially to zero as we increase the resolution. So that also tells you how smooth the solution is. Okay. Since I'm solving the Einstein vacuum equations, then they are scale invariant. So I can always fix an overall scale. So what we do here is just to fix the length of the compact circle. And then once you've done that, then the non-uniform life strings form a one-parameter family of solutions, which in this case, this parameter is basically this parameter R0 that I have here, which basically corresponds to the temperature. So to move along the branch, I'll fix the length of the compact circle, and then I'll just vary the temperature. If I do that, then I'll just explore the whole branch. Okay, very good. So let me show you the results. So here, what I'm plotting the mass on this axis against inverse temperature, that's this parameter beta, which is basically proportional to this parameter R0 that I have. And I'm doing this in 11, 12, 13, and 14 dimensions. So in these plots, our data are these red curves, and these black curves, which are hopefully visible, they correspond to the uniform light stream. Okay? So, as you can see, in all number of dimensions, you see that there's a critical value of R0 at which this non-uniform light stream branch emerges from the uniform one. That's basically the Gregory-Laffan point. So here, that's the Gregory-Laffan point. So basically what you do, you can start the perturbation and then you add it to the regular Laffan point, and from there you can move along the non-uniform. So in 11 dimensions, then basically you see that the mass is a monotonic function of beta. This is true in all number of dimensions less or equal to 11. So as you move along this curve, then the non-uniformity of the stream increases, and in fact somewhere very close to this point is where the merger, which is the localized black hole branch, happens. So this is in all in lower dimensions less than 11 or 11. This is what happens in all cases. Now, in 12 dimensions, the situation is more interesting. So we see that in this region over here, which is where the strings are not so non-uniform, then basically the behavior is similar to what you have in 11 dimensions, and that's what perturbation theory involves. Okay, so when I run there, then that behavior is the same as in lower dimensions. But interestingly, at some point, there's a minimum temperature along the branch, somewhere there, and then the curve turns around and it goes up. And at this point, you have a maximum mass. So and then it goes down. So the strings become more non-uniform as you do this along this curve, and the merger happens again somewhere close here. So in 11 dimensions, then there is a maximum value of the mass that non-uniform black strings can have. And as we'll see later, then these white strings will be unstable for the reason that I said before. Because again, if you have a 12 dimensional non-uniform black string, which sits at the top of the maximum mass, then you throw a particle and then it has nowhere else to go.
Well, can I ask all that? So why would you, fly away? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a naive value. You have to do the calculation because, non-linear effects could be important in this problem.
the case that comes to mind is the case of an extremely curved black hole.
Yes.
When actually a tree branches from a northern black hole wall, so that if you try to send a charged particle in, it just bumps off and that never falls in.
But there's no repulsive force here, right? I could just plot a shell on top of this.
Yeah, but.
I mean, I agree the calculation would have to be done, but it's hard to see, unlike in that case where you can see where the repulsive forces come from.
Right.
Because it's going to be.
Yeah, but even in that case, one, it's. Yeah. I think you have to be careful and you have to take into account some linear effects. That this can be important. But in any case, naively, this is what you would expect. And in fact, when you do the calculation, then that has to be fine. But the solution is in there, it's unstable. So you find a similar thing happens to the ring, where it sits at the curve. Then you can think that you can try to throw some mass into it and then move up. So you can also show that this will be unstable. Okay, so that's an unexpected result, that there isn't this maximum mass along the non-uniform branch. And actually this equation is kind of similar in 13 dimensions. Again, the branch starts there. In this case, there is no minimum temperature, or if you want, the minimum temperature is precisely the point where the solution starts existing. And then at some point, there's a maximum mass, and then the solution goes down like that. And again, the merger happens somewhere close to the end.
Can you understand anything from the fact that the slope is some sense of the parts to the right and then you can see
that basically is saying that the thermal ensemble is different. It changes so that it's basically depending on the ensemble you look at. In the thermal ensemble, then it's a stable, neutral, and stable. It's just that.
So the weakly nonlinear regime is very small.
Exactly. So if you compare the full nonlinear results with the linear results,
right.
In this case, basically you see that they only agree in a tiny, tiny, tiny region over here, where in all of the cases you get pretty good answers, all to reasonable value of lambda. But in this case, perturbation theory breaks down very quickly.
But do you see that the slope is the way?
The slope at this point, perturbation theory tells you that the slope should be that.
Okay, so that's consistent.
That's consistent.
Is
it's all consistent with perturbation theory, but in this case, the validity of perturbation theory is very small. Okay? Because, I mean, these solutions, the lambda of this solution is not big, it's like 0.1 in this case, and I think it's 0.3 in this case. So they're not very uniform. Well, in 14 dimensions, then again, they go this way, they become more than uniform as you go down, but in this case, again, the mass is a monotonic function. So that's what they Now, one of the points was to check whether they have more or less entropy than the uniform black string. So what I'm plotting here is the area of the horizon of the non-uniform black string over the area of the horizon of a uniform black string with the same mass. And my plot. Okay? So in 11 dimensions, you see that this function is always negative, even for large values of this non-uniform parameter, which that's the situation in all number of dimensions equal or less than 11. It's basically saying that non-uniform black strings always have less entropy than uniform black strings. So there are no surprises here. In 12 dimensions, the situation is more interesting. So this function, again, starts being negative. That's what perturbation theory is all about, but it's all consistent. But at some point, it turns around and non-uniform black strings start dominating. So they are the highest entropy state for the same mass. And similarly, in 13 dimensions, in this case, maybe it's hard to see, but this function is negative in the tiny region over here, but then it turns out and starts being positive for large values of lambda. And in 14 dimensions, then this function is always positive. And that's again, in agreement with perturbation theory, or what the expectations would be. So, in 12 and 13 dimensions, there are non-uniform black strings, which you might think that they might be stable. And again, in 14 dimensions, you might hope that they are stable as well. So,
isn't that just related to what you were talking about before, the slopes of those lines?
Yeah,
is that the slopes of those lines are the incapacities?
Yes. Yes, in a way, yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. In fact, as we'll see later, the point sitting at the maximum mass, then the heat capacity vanishes. And this will turn out to have an important effect in the Pendulum's inequality. Because this precisely heat capacity shows up in the Pendulum's inequality. So in actually goes all over the capacity. We'll see that in a minute. Okay, so basically let me summarize very quickly the phase diagram of this static nodes going off code. So in all dimensions equal or less to 11, we've got these following phases. We've got the uniform black strings, which exist for any value of the area and the mass. So here I'm plotting the area of the horizon against mass. At some point, we've got the uniform black strings, then these functions are monotonic, and they just exist for where they exist, and then at some point they merge. In this region where they exist, that these non-uniform black strings are the phase which have lowest entropy for the same mass. Okay? Just draw a vertical line here that always have less entropy. Then at some point they merge with the localized black holes. These localized black holes in this region here, they are basically round, close to a asymptotically flat structure of black holes. And then as you move along the branch, they become bigger and bigger, they get to form, that's a maximum mass solution, and then goes down and then they merge with the non-uniform. In 12 and 13 dimensions, the picture is kind of similar, but now this maximum mass solution sits on the non-uniform side. But the rest is basically the same. And again, in this region over here, then non-uniform black strings should be the phase with highest entropy for a given mass. And in 14 and higher dimensions, then we are in the maximally boring situation where basically, well, we've got here a point here, then there's but non-uniform black strings dominate, then they merge with the localized black holes. I should say though that this is conjectural because these localized black holes are only known in 5 or 6 dimensions. So maybe something more interesting happens here. You just don't know, but that's the simplest baseline that you can go. Okay, good. So that's all I have to say for the non-uniform black strings and their phase diagram and their construction. So now let me discuss that stability using something called Penrose inequalities. So first I'll explain these Penrose inequalities, and then I'll explain how they can be used to study stability. But to motivate this, So if you wanted to study, say, the stability of this object, of this non-uniform black string, or whatever high-dimensional black hole using the traditional approach, then basically you would perturb the metric, and then you have to solve the linearized Einstein equation, right? Which is a system of PDEs, and that's a hard problem. Okay. A hard problem is you want to do that, you face a number of difficulties. In particular, you first have to fix the gauge, and that's something which can be tricky. You have to make sure that there's no individual gauge freedom. And once you've done that, then you find that some subset of these equations become constraints. So you have to ensure that they are implied by the other dynamical equations, and that also depends on your choice of boundary conditions. So that's possibly
you mean consistent with your
yes. You have a dynamical equation and you have to check that if those are satisfied, then the constraints will be satisfied. So that's a trivial thing.
I agree.
So you have to check that. And that also depends on your choice of boundary. That's a delicate point. But more fundamentally, I mean, in general, in four dimensions, the fact that we can write down an equation which controls the gravitational perturbation of the curve is like almost a miracle, right? In high dimensions, you could not expect this to happen. Right? So this will form a system of coupled PDEs, and in general it would not be possible to decouple them and not to say to separate variables. So we have to solve, you know, just a system of PDEs, and that's hard. As you go up in dimension, then it's just going to become harder because there are more degrees of freedom. So clearly, you know, we want to do this in an efficient manner, so it's quite desirable to have a better way of doing this. And that's what the Penrose inequality would allow us. So, our approach is based on two facts about evolution in GR. One of them is that basically that the area of the horizon under time of evolution increases. And the second one is that in asymptotically flat spaces or asymptotic closed-line spacetimes, the energy decreases with time, which is basically a consequence of the fact that gravitational waves carry energy, and in these spacetimes, then they can scale to infinity. The fact this is not a fundamental point in our approach, so as long as this is zero, our approach also works. So that's the case for EPS. So even if the energy is conserved, then well, what I will say just goes through. And so just using these two facts, we can argue that the black hole must be unstable in the following way.
So in case of EPS, I can think about this energy as a boundary.
As the total energy contained in your space-time.
As a boundary.
Yes, yes, the energy,
energy,
the energy,
energy,
energy, energy, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a total energy, that's concern. That's right. Okay, so you can argue in the following way. So consider the mass as a function of the area of the horizon on your initial data slides. Okay? So in this initial data slide, then what holds? Then it should form a curve because the area is a function, is a known function of the mass is a known function of the horizon. So here, just for the sake of simplicity, I'm keeping all the other, say, physical quantities fixed, like angular momentum, whatever. So black holes form a curve, and elsewhere in this diagram, and you've got the black hole with say, radiation or whatever. So now suppose that you start somewhere on this curve, at a known black hole. Okay? Now you perturb it a little bit. And suppose that your perturbation takes you somewhere there. Okay? Now under time evolution, because the area has to decrease and the area has to increase and the mass has to decrease, then clearly you can go back to this curve and you will end up somewhere here. It's just another black hole within the same family, but with just a small variation of the parameters. Okay, so that would, as we would say that under these conditions, under this perturbation, this black hole would be stable. But now suppose that you construct a perturbation which takes you somewhere there, under this curve, in this red region. Then clearly, under time evolution, you can only go that way. You will not be able to get back to this curve. So, if you lie here, then clearly, this black hole must be unstable. Okay? So that's a basic idea. And what the parameters inequality will tell us is precisely where we are on this diagram. Yes?
Does this argument assume cosmic censorship in higher dimensions?
Yeah, I'm assuming that. At least, and because I will only discuss this locally, just for small perturbations, then I only need this to hold just for a small amount of time. So I don't need to hold it for forever, in the sense that I only need to assume that the horizon will not be destroyed immediately for what I'm going to say to work. But it's still true that the area grows. And yeah, so let me actually go to this point. So let me now explain this Penrose inequality, because this was introduced by Penrose precisely motivated by cosmic censorship. So basically these Penrose inequalities are bound on the area of the apparent horizon on the initial data slides in terms of the area of the event horizon of a given black hole evaluated at the total energy on your initial data slides. So this inequality, so basically what Penrose was saying is that, so what Penrose's conjecture is that for any initial data that you can construct in four dimensions, then the area of your apparent horizon should be bounded by a function of the energy. And that precisely the inequality that he wrote, and this function here is just the area of the event horizon of a short-tailed black hole. So Penrose would say that with conjecture, that for any initial data that you consider, then the area of your apparent horizon must be less than this limit here. So this assumes that this initial data will settle down to a member of the curve family. And basically his motivation was that by studying these inequalities, if you could find a counterexample, something that violated this inequality, then maybe that would provide a counterexample to cosmic censorship. And so in this case, you only have equality for if your initial data is exactly short sharp. Now, proving this, that these holes for any initial data is a very hard problem, and only recently it was possible to prove that this holds for time-symmetric initial data. But for general initial data, that's still not known. So another version of these Penrose inequalities is a local version, which was used by Harry Hibbert, which basically just amounts to just consider the perturbative version of this inequality around a given space. So in particular, what you did is just consider perturbation of Schwarzschild and then check whether these inequalities will satisfy for these perturbations. And that's basically what we are going to use in higher dimensions. But the bottom line is that in writing down these inequalities, you are assuming that your spacetime will settle down to a given black hole that you like.
So in Gary's version, what was the output? Because if I run the perturbation slightly a black hole, I'm not going to violate it.
Well, he wanted to show that this is what happened. That if you perturb the structure, you will not violate this inequality, and therefore, proper mistake. That was basically what he wanted to do. So, how do you derive this inequality? So let me go through that quickly. So basically, the idea is the following. Just consider a hole, the one that you want. In this case, in this talk, I'll consider non-uniform black strings, but you can take any black hole you want. Take a known black hole so that you know this function. So that's known for any given family of black holes. So now consider initial data, which is just a small perturbation of your stationary black hole spacetime. And then assume that the spacetime settles down to another member of this family, but with just a small change of the physical pattern. Okay? So with these assumptions, we can derive the permanence inequality in the following way. So first of all, on the initial data slides, we know that the apparent horizon is bounded by the intersection of the area of the event of the event horizon with the initial data slides, because the apparent horizon lies inside the event horizon. Okay, so that's the area of the event horizon on the initial data slides. The apparent horizon lies inside the event horizon. Now, under time evolution, the area of the event horizon will grow, so this will be less than the area of the final event horizon. And finally, because the area is an increasing function of the mass by the first law, then we know that this will be less than the area of the event horizon evaluated at the total energy in your initial data slides. And that's basically the form of the Clairaut's inequality that I wrote earlier. So all I assume here is that I know what this function is. So basically I'm assuming that the spacetime will settle down to a member of this family of black holes. So that's all I'm assuming here. So basically, if you find initial data for which the Clairaut's inequality is violated, then clearly one of the assumptions that went into this derivation must be wrong. So in particular, what must be wrong is the assumption that it settles down to this particular family of black holes. Therefore, you conclude that there must be an instability. I'm saying that in this talk, I'll be interested in studying perturbations, so you can just expand this inequality in perturbation theory, and then you'll find that the first contribution is, so this in perturbation theory, this just boils down to this inequality, where this m double dot is the second order perturbation in the mass, that's the temperature of your space black hole, that's the second order perturbation of the area of the apparent horizon, the first order perturbation of the mass, and that's basically the specific E. So it was shown by Hollett and Wald that precisely this quantity here is the canonical energy of your perturbations, and they showed that if this inequality is violated, then this is a necessary and sufficient condition for the existence of an instability at the linear level, that is to say, a mode that grows with time. So let me just make a quick comment on
the CL is the CL of the unperturbed solution.
Yes, specifically that constant of the unperturbed solution. So you know this function. So in the asymptotically flat case for rotating black holes, we derive a similar inequality. And basically in here, this function here, now we've got the angular momentum of your final black hole. But that's not very useful because in general we don't know what this angular momentum is going to be. So we cannot put bounds on this function, so we don't know what it is. So basically what we did is that you can assume that your perturbations preserve the end computing rotational symmetries of your spacetime. And if you make this assumption, then angular momentum is conserved. So then you're basically derive a useful form of the Clairaut's inequality, where now this is just fixed and will be preserved by inclusion.
So the way for me to think of this suggests that I do something to my space-time, and doing that I've added energy, so
yep.
Now I've increased the ADM mass.
Yes.
And then I'm going to ask, what if the horizon area is bigger than the black hole solution that I know and love, with that new ADM mass, then it can't settle down to that. It has to be.
So you've got this total ADM mass in the initial data slides, and you assume that the spacetime will settle down to your frame rate black hole, so you know this function. And then you can say, because it must grow in time, because the area of the horizon grows, then you know what this function will be. And then, moreover, because this function is an increasing function of the mass, and if you evaluate it at the total initial mass, then this provides you a bound. And the thing is that if you violate this bound, then it tells you that this assumption that the spacetime settles down to this component you chose must be wrong. So therefore,
So then why do we need to write down this evolutionary equation that you just showed in the previous slide that's necessary and sufficient for instability?
So
in the previous slide, you showed an equation of that was necessary and sufficient for an instability to exist. But is that just saying, is that just going one step further and saying how exactly it's going to evolve? It's, okay. So I know already when the equality is violated that something crazy has to happen.
Yes.
And the purpose of this equation is to say what?
Yes. So basically, you could say that if this is violated, then that's maybe necessary, but not sufficient for the existence of a real
problem. I mean, it gives you more information, but it still is an inequality.
So
if it were a sharp or equal to something, then you could say, oh, this word is just missing.
Well, like now, I mean, if all I want to know is whether or not after deformation it's going to go back to a black hole or if it's going to go somewhere else, I just need to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm just trying to understand what additional information do I miss?
I'm just telling you that there's an exponentially growing mode, unstable mode.
Basically.
So it's just
telling
you
how it's
done.
Sorry,
I'm not telling
you
how much it
goes back. What is m0? That's the first perturbation of the mass. That's the perturbation of the
mass. We know for any stationary space time that it's always identical.
So here, the dot means derivative, again, with respect to the sort of parameter that tells you how far you depart from the stationary. It's not time derivative. So I expand a metric like g plus epsilon a. So this is derivative with respect to this expansion parameter.
Yeah,
it's not time derivative.
No, but we know those are always here. We know that's always here.
No,
so
it's not.
Dot means derivative with respect to this expansion parameter. It's not time derivative.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Your expansion parameters are varying. It's the first law.
It's the second variation.
So I've got the metric, right?
The
metric.
The second. The first one would have only one data.
Right. So that's why it's
one. So basically,
and double notch.
So I'm expanding the metric in this form, right? So that's the first perturbation. The first order perturbation. So this will induce a change in the mass, right, in my space line. So the change in the mass induced by the first order perturbation of the metric is what I call m dot zero. Okay. So when you do perturbation theory, you can expand your metric in this way, and then you just compute one of these in as a.
I don't know if that's what you mean, but if you have a metric field, right? So then if you perturb it, then the back reaction of the geometry is put there. In the small.
I mean, that's what we do. I mean,
right,
more fundamental.
Here, it's not, it has to be, it's just deforming.
Yeah.
It must be deforming in the way that violates tensor quantity.
Sorry?
It must be violating in the. If that's non zero, it must be.
But it is. You showed in this picture, it's
by
just adding that, just right, throwing a particle or something. Right?
Yeah, no, that one, that's non reciprocal. But you're probably adding in terms of could add k momentum or something like that. So that would violate what I said. Keep going.
Okay.
Since we're on this whole general question, there's another method that works for stellar stability and so on for diagnosing instabilities, which is called the turning point. Right?
Yeah, that's basically.
Is that essentially equivalent to what you're
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, that's
it looks like.
Yeah, that's basically what this is. But in a way, it's telling you how. Well, okay, maybe I can discuss it later. It's basically this. It's telling you. Okay, let me speed up a little bit. So, yeah, let me just walk on my ABS spacetime, because in this case, everything is conserved. Then you can derive an equality in this form without assuming that the perturbation satisfies half any symmetry. So this is a must be doing ABS without any further assumption of the symmetry. And that would be something interesting to look at. Okay, so our strategy, let me summarize our strategy for finding instabilities. Is to construct initial data at the second order perturbation theory and basically check whether it violates or not the parameter. If it does, then we know. So how do you do that? So to construct initial data, we have to solve the constraint equations. So these are formulated in terms of an initial Cauchy surface. induced metric and statistic curvature. For me, these are the induced metric of the non-uniform light string on T-post constant lines, and these vanishes for the non-uniform light string. And then on top of these, I construct new initial data, which corresponds to the perturbations. And because we want to keep this method as simple as possible, I just rescale the induced metric in this way. And then this new data is honest initial data for the Anderson equations, as long as these functions are defined in this simple scale equation, where this operator is defined with respect to the metric that I chose initially, which I know has a non-uniform light string. Okay, so all we have to do to solve this equation, that's a simple scale of PDE, there are no gauge issues, no anything. So that's a lot simpler than solving the full traditional perturbation equations. Moreover, we want to expand this perturbation theory, so then we just expand this function into a small parameter, and then dot here being the derivative with respect to this expansion parameter, and then this equation just falls out into just a couple of linear equations. So I wrote down this explicitly because in the case where your background doesn't satisfy the constraint, then you have some kind of non-linearity, so it becomes more than trivial. But basically, that's all you have to solve. Linear equations, subject to certain boundary. So let me just describe it very quickly. So I'm choosing a T-post constant slice from the non-uniform string background. This slice goes from one asymptotically cone-defined region, and it goes through the bifurcation surface into another asymptotically cone-defined region. So we chose coordinates which are regular on the bifurcation surface. So only, say, this portion of the spacetime here is the physical one. So on this portion, we'll require that the spacetime is asymptotically cone-defined. But then, because we don't care what happens on this other portion of the spacetime, we'll just prescribe some Dirichlet boundary conditions. So we'll just fix these functions that we give whatever we want. In, for the data that I'm going to present next, then we'll just fix this function to the constant there, and this function to be zero, and then because satisfies this Laplace equation, it's zero everywhere. So so now we have to solve for one function with simple boundary conditions. So in this setting, then we solve this equation, and then we compute the physical quantities and check whether the premise uniform is satisfied. So this is what we found. In 11, 12, 13, and 14 dimensions, so here I'm plotting this quantity Q that I defined earlier as a function of the non-uniformity parameter. And again, I chose data so that I just fix this perturbation to be constant. So, what we find? In 11 dimensions, we find that this quantity is always negative. So this is a violation of the Perron's inequality, so all these light strings are unstable, even for finite values of lambda. Situation is more interesting in 12 and 13 dimensions, where this quantity starts being negative. So again, in this region over here, got a violation of the Perron's inequality, therefore these black strings must be unstable. Then in fact, this goes to infinity at this point. So this point is precisely where this maximum mass solution sits. So the specific heat is zero. And recall that in the Perron's inequality, the specific heat appears dividing. So clearly, if this goes to zero, this instability will just get stronger. And in fact, one can show that the solution sitting there precisely at that point is unstable. And then as you go on the other side, then this Q is positive. So at least this tells you that the spacetime should be stable under this perturbation. So the drawback of our method is that if you find an instability, then you're done. If you don't find an instability, then you can't really say much. So it may be that you should consider more general class of initial data. So what we did to check this was to expand this boundary condition in a Fourier series and minimize the and look for the coefficients so that it minimizes quantity Q, and we couldn't find any instability. We also deformed the background, introducing the free function, which we chose, and we chose it so that it induced kind of certain deformations that could sort of, you know, drive the matching towards instabilities, and we couldn't find any instability. So I think it's kind of suggesting that these large strings are all stable. Finally, okay, so in 14 dimensions, then it's kind of the same. So Q is always positive for these large classes of initial data that we consider. And that's true for all lambda that we
What was this lambda again?
Lambda is a non-uniformity parameter of the black string. So when it's when it's zero, it's a non-uniform black string, and when it's non-zero, it just measures how non-uniform your black string are.
In the internal direction.
In the cone-defined direction.
So that shows indeed equal 14 is unstable
So in Higgs for me, they are stable. So Q is positive, so that they are stable. And lower dimensions, they are unstable.
What? Oh, sorry, that's the equals 12.
So that's 12. So in this region here, they are stable, and they are unstable in this region here.
But that means that so even the uniform one is unstable.
Yes, don't leave that away.
You know that away. That's the, is that the Gregory rule of thumb?
Yes, that's the Gregory rule of thumb. Okay, so yeah, since I'm out of time, I'm just summarize. So we constructed one uniform extension in a number of dimensions from 10 to 15. It turned out that in 12 and 13 we have a maximum mass on the range, so that's sort of something we just kind of expected. Then using these premise inequalities, we showed that all these questions are unstable in lower dimensions. In 12 and 13, there's a region where they are unstable, and they are stable otherwise, and in higher dimensions, they're all stable. At least for the ones that we should be able to use. And yeah, so have some other slides, maybe. Okay, thank you.
So I just have one question about the turning point method. Maybe this is not quite equivalent, but if it is, there should be a simpler way of getting instability in some cases. Because as I understand the turning point method, it doesn't require you to explicitly look at a perturbation at all. You only need to track certain quantities along the manifold of equilibrium.
Yeah, so the thing is that what is your manifold of equilibrium in the turning point method?
Any manifold. Any manifold would be good.
Yeah, I think that basically, my concern is that I don't know what this manifold equilibrium is, right? It's probably.
No, I mean, you don't have to know the full manifold of equilibrium. You need to know some manifold. But
sure.
And one thing that it won't do for you, if it's unstable, as I recall, it won't give you, if the whole manifold is unstable, it won't necessarily show you that. It'll show you where instability sets in. But you had some cases where an instability did set in at a certain place along the curve of equilibrium, right?
Yes, that's right.
So I think you just need to have, if you have just a one parameter set of equilibrium, you can apply it to that. It may miss some instability. If it's really part of a two parameter family, then there's a more generalized form of it. Need to know the behavior along, I mean, if you know the behavior along the second parameter, then you can sometimes find an instability that you would have missed by only looking at the first parameter. But since your aim is sort of to produce an instability,
yes.
More you can't really rule out an instability. You can't prove stability, but you can prove instability. So I think the same comments apply to the turning point method.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't require you to solve all these perturbation
equations.
So I'm just wondering if this you're doing something beyond turning point?
Yeah, it's
you
just
could have applied the turning point method to
so
get some of these results.
Yeah, basically the turning point method would just, in this case, would just be at the level of this thermodynamic quantity. Just check where you've got the turning point method would tell you that at this minimum, at this maximum mass, you had a new mode, unstable mode coming in. But it wouldn't tell you whether you are unstable all the way on this sort of portion of the fundamental solution. So the turning point method will tell you where this instability sets in, and it would have told you that it sets in size of this maximum mass solution. But it wouldn't tell you that there are these other portion of the branch is unstable. So it's in a way similar to that. But
so you're saying it would give the only extra information you're getting here is that the instability continues for
exactly. So we get all the
arbitrarily.
Yeah, that's right. And also we construct instability specifically, right? So we construct initial data which will not settle down to these bundle solutions that we started with. But with the turning point method, you don't construct the actual instability. So it's in a way similar, but in some other way it goes.
But you would have got quite a lot of information. I mean, you would have found that there was an instability. You would find where it started.
Yes.
And that could be done much more easily.
Yes, that's right.
To go through all of
I agree completely, but again, it only tells me what this sets in.
Right. And then maybe in your 12 dimensional case, maybe it wouldn't tell you because it's unstable from the very beginning. So there's no place in which it sets in, perhaps.
You could
come from the other direction.
Exactly.
Yeah, so then in all cases, it would give you a very strong indication of where the instability, the unstable region was.
Yeah, that's right. But, yeah.
going back to black screen, so some years ago, Rob Myers and Optimal wrote a paper with post now spring make go to the stable branch, or but they that was a projection. Are you guys know that?
No, because yeah, that's a good question, but I guess in this case, I guess we kind of boost it, right? Because it is, so they boost it along this sort of compact direction.
Yeah.
So in this case, this is not symmetry, so I'm not sure how you would do that.
You couldn't
charge it in that way because it's not symmetric. Well, it's not symmetry anymore.
Yeah, you presumably have to, you'd have to do it by hand.
Yeah, I was wondering if one could extend this analysis.
Yeah, no.
To do what? So I didn't
hear that. To add charge to it. If you didn't break the KK string, you just by boosting.
You can. If you take this boosted black string, or even charged black string, you can very simply extend all this on the background of this boosted black string. And in that case, you have to solve just for the E's. At least that's what we did just for the not uniform black string. And you're left to solve another E. And yeah, because this initial data is. It's not exactly the unstable mode, it has some. Then you don't get a sort of a sharp result as for the that tells you when the onset is. But you get a very, very good estimate. So, for example, for uniform black strings, we could find the instability, the onset of the variable of instability within, say, less than 1% in any number of dimensions. And exactly, as we went up in dimensions, I think these measures had better.
What if you applied it? So that's it. Maybe a case for the turning point method that would establish the existence of the instability with much less work. I mean, if you just understood the nature of that equilibrium manifold, including charge.
I'm not sure the turning point method in that case would work.
Well, there's a higher dimensional analog of the turning point method. It doesn't just use a one parameter set. There's just some sort of I forget how it goes, but. Some sort of simple inequality of determinants or something like that that you can show.
What's the sales pitch for why you should care about dimensions higher than 11? Not to be, okay, this is something new.
In a world where we're already wondering what 11 is.
I'm sorry? Wait, what?
In a world where we already wonder about 10 or 11.
Yeah.
Well, okay. There are some of us who would argue we should be interested up to 10 and 11.
Sure, I can do it.
But so, I mean, gravity is GR. If you don't care about ABSA field strength, I mean, GR is a perfectly well formulated theory in any number of dimensions. So then you might as well just ask, I mean, what are the dynamics of you change that?
Yeah, but he wants to buy it.
No.
Well, so why not? I guess.
But no, so there's some interesting stuff, right, about gravity going on, and which might be easier in higher dimensions.
But there could be, if you care about string theory, then, you know, you can try to think in terms of, okay, so with his symmetry, it's probably tricky, but some of the models, you know, you could go with quantum reduction, right? Then you would interpret it as, you know, your model in whatever lower number of space time dimensions, but with matter present, right?
Dimensional only goes one way.
No, I would do a climb reduction on the you know S to minus three. Okay. He would do all the same computation as he's doing because whatever you're solving with 1 + 1 dimensional.
Yeah, is that 2-dimensional?
Yeah, 2-dimensional. Right. So now all I'm saying is that how can you prove me consistent with that I cannot come up with a compactification in the string theory on you know, wherever some smaller dimensional manifold that will lead in some approximation to the effective action is a key gas.
Well, I'd say the shoe's on the other foot.
Sorry?
I'd say the shoe's on the other foot. But.
I don't know. String theory, for example, there is a 12 dimensions. String theory depends. If you take the B field, you include the B field, then you can interpret it as morpholized to do it with the F theory, which is 12 dimensions. So this is again, once you have, you know, extra metric fields, there are various ways.
I'm not saying that it's obvious, I was just asking what the pitch was.
More fundamental. I mean, you want to understand, say, the dynamics of gravity, right? There might be effects that are just simple in high dimensions. right? Which you then, you might learn about some sort of more general stuff. I mean, like what Lisa and Franz say, right? So coordinate sensitivity is violating higher dimensions, and a very simple system to look at where this happened is not uniform black frame, right? So you might think of, and then you can infer like generic properties of gravity, right? So I think thanks to that result, and we know that in high dimensions, there's no reason to expect cosmic sensitivity to fall. And if you come up with a problem or a model in high dimensions where it's so event that you're interested in, maybe simpler to study in that setting, then you might learn some more general lesson about GR.
Or again, GR with method. Some of the problems of GR in lower dimensions with method could interpret as a GR without method in high dimensions. It might be equivalent.
So in fact,
it's not impossible, but
so
there's no reason to believe that it's true.
But I mean, in fact, if you write down the Einstein equations for these models, basically you have four-dimensional gravity coupled, or in case it's like two-dimensional gravity coupled to a scalar with a form of the potential which arises in some compactification of string theories.
Yeah,
that this kind of real type potentials which are commonplace in
these type of things. You know, the existence of the cusps is very common in ABS solution. So if I look on branches of black holes, and those branches sometimes you can find cusps if you call it mass over temperature. And those things arise, so they do not arise in pure ABS gravity, but they arise in ABS gravity with matter gravity. So you might expect that some universal properties of the cusp, like stability or something that Paul is talking about, again, it's just a property of, they arise from PDE, and as long as, you have the same reduced effective action, then, why would you care where does it come from? And sometimes this picture might be cleaner or simpler to understand. No method is always easy to understand.
Well, it's equivalent to one, though. I think we're just going around the park.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Paul again.